Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second hour of the Arizona Republic. This is the Sunday, October 12th, 2025 issue, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. During this hour, I'll be covering the obituaries, the business news, local sports, some opinions, and we'll end up with the horoscope and the funnies. So I hope you enjoy the program. I'll begin with the obituaries. Raymond Philip Anderson, 71, of Mesa. Marcelina Arvello, 100, Tempe. Sandra K. Barrett, 79, Mesa. Zandra Barth, no age or town provided. Jennifer Borna, 54, of Phoenix. Sally Harmon Close, 72, Chandler. Judith Edna Conway, 90, Phoenix. Ramon Figueroa, 84, of Phoenix. Constant L. Gayor, 80, of Miami, Arizona. Thomas Albert Heiser, 63, of Scottsdale. Christopher Peter Natavangi, 70, of Mesa. Cecilia C.C. Leon, 86, of Phoenix. Charles Chuck Mullins, 68, of Scottsdale. Judith Lee Page, 83, of Phoenix. Catherine Louise Skaggs, 90, of Sun City. Wanda Turley Smith, 99, Phoenix. James Nicholas Von Germiten, 86, Phoenix. Joseph Timothy Hawk Wolf, 82, no town listed. And Ken Wright, 88, of Surprise. And that completes the obituaries. Next up is the local business news. The first article is titled, Joanne Yarn Fabric to Return in Michael's Stores, by Chad Murphy of the Akron Beacon Journal and the USA Today Network. Joanne Fabrics, the popular sewing and crafts retailer that closed its 800-plus stores in May, is making a comeback. Kind of. Michaels, the craft retailer that purchased Jones' intellectual property in June, recently announced the debut of the Knit and Sew Shop, featuring Joanne branding and private label brands from the bankrupt retailer. Now in Michael's stores across North America, the Knit and Sew Shop, marked with both the Joanne and Michael's logos, aims to bring the best of both together. The launch of the Knit and Sew Shop and the Party Shop at Michael's is a transformative step forward in our mission to become the go-to destination for fueling creativity and celebration, Michael's CEO David Boone said in a statement. We are proud to offer an unmatched experience for creating and celebrating through our expansive product assortments, enhanced services, lower price points, and seamless in-store and online shopping options. The dual-branded shop offers a curated assortment of threads, sewing notions, and yarn, with fabric also available in most stores. The selection includes Joanne brands like Big Twist. Other additions include fabric. Michael's now carries fabric in more than 840 stores, with plans to expand to more than 250 additional locations. Michaels has also increased the existing space dedicated to fabric in stores by nearly 25%, expanded assortment in most locations, and made over 95,000 options available online. Sewing and yarn. Michaels has increased in-store space for sewing and yarn assortments and is actively expanding its yarn selection by 25% this year to meet customer demand. Hundreds of new skeins are being added, including new brands and Joann private label favorites. Michaels also has welcomed Gutermann threads as well as new sewing machines from Singer and Brother. Sewing notions, beginner needle crafting kits, and more. The Knit and Sew Shop features new in-store services as well, including fabric cutting tables. In addition, Michaels is debuting the Party Shop, expanding its party space in every store to accommodate 700 new products. Joann closed all its locations after filing for bankruptcy in January. And that completes the first article, Joann Yarn, Fabric to Return in Michaels Stores, by Chad Murphy of the Akron Beacon Journal and the USA Today Network. The next article is Scandals Sink CEOs Faster Than Fraud, Research Shows, by Michael Nalick of the University of Denver and The Conversation. A CEO's canoodling with his company's human resources chief, caught on the Kiss Cam at a Coldplay concert, made global headlines this summer. Beyond the memes and tabloid fodder, personal lives were shattered, and a company was left in turmoil after its leader's sudden exit. The case involving the AI firm Astronomer may be the most visible of recent CEO personal scandals. Think sex affairs, drug abuse, or embarrassing behavior. But it's not an isolated incident. Just weeks following the Coldplay Kiss Cam, the CEO of Nestle was shown the door for similar behavior involving a relationship with a subordinate. Personal scandals have been the top cause of CEO terminations in recent years. How do these scandals stack up to other corporate indiscretions, such as financial fraud? As a management professor, I knew that there's lots of research on CEOs' financial crimes, but little on personal misdeeds. So my colleagues and I examined nearly 400 CEO scandals involving either financial or personal misconduct. In this research, published in August 2025 in the journal Strategic Organization, we found that not all CEO scandals were treated equally. The type makes all the difference. For most people, personal indiscretions, such as having an extramarital affair or abusing drugs, are a private matter. But for CEOs, even scandals unrelated to business create doubt about their judgment, integrity, and leadership. The result is usually career-ending, research shows, and can create lasting harm for the company. We found that CEOs overwhelmingly exit in the wake of personal scandals, 5 times as often as CEOs who commit financial misconduct do, in fact. For example, Hewlett-Packard's Mark Hurd, who's widely credited with turning around HP in the mid-2000s, was ousted following a very visible personal misconduct scandal 15 years ago. The fallout was swift. The company's stock fell nearly 10% immediately after the announcement. And with leadership in a tailspin, it dropped more than 40% within a year. Companies also are routinely accused of cooking the books. In recent months, several firms have been forced to restate their earnings after their financial statements didn't add up. These scandals shake investor trust, trigger sharp drops in company stock, and often lead to the chief financial officer's departure, with some CEOs following suit. However, while cooking the books is considered a severe form of corporate misconduct, Our research suggests that it has fewer job-ending repercussions for CEOs than personal scandals do. Roughly half of all CEOs implicated in financial scandals survive, we found. Because, unlike in personal scandals, CEOs can often shift blame. It might be surprising to learn that a CEO's personal misconduct can come at a greater cost, both to the business and the executive, than outright financial fraud. Is corporate America overestimating the importance of private behavior, or is it underestimating the importance of cooking the books? While I don't have the answer to these questions, I think our findings show the need for more discussion and more research. That completes the article, Scandals Sink CEOs Faster Than Fraud, Research Says, by Michael Nalick from the University of Denver. The last business article today is titled, Cracker Barrel Ends Deal with Agency Pitching Logo Change, by Greta Cross and Melina Kahn of USA Today. The old-timer Cracker Barrel logo is here to stay. The eatery has ended its partnership with the creative agency that advised the logo change and restaurant's stripped-down redesign. Cracker Barrel confirmed in an October 2nd news release it has ended its engagement with Prophet, the company that encouraged Cracker Barrel to update its logo and restaurant design. While Cracker Barrel did not explicitly state the reasoning behind the decision, it comes weeks after the restaurant chain announced a change to its logo, sparkling online debate and even drumming up comments from President Donald Trump. But after much debate, the restaurant chain put the logo debate to bed and reverted to its traditional logo. On August 19th, Cracker Barrel revealed a new logo. Though it stayed true to the original gold and brown color palette, the logo only featured the Cracker Barrel name on a simple background, removing the iconic man and wooden barrel. The logo led to heated debates online, with one Instagram user calling the redesign cold and sterile. The backlash led to a dip Cracker Barrel stock value. When the market closed on August 20th, Cracker Barrel shares were valued at $59.02. They took a turn on August 21st, with stock prices falling to $50.76 by midday. Just 6 days after the logo's launch, Cracker Barrel issued a statement addressing the public comments. If the last few days have shown us anything, it's how deeply people care about Cracker Barrel. We're truly grateful for your heartfelt voices, the company said on August 25th. You've also shown us that we could have done a better job sharing who we are and who we'll always be. The logo debate reached a peak when it sparked a response from Trump. Cracker Barrel should go back to the old logo, admit a mistake based on customer response, the ultimate poll, and manage the company better than ever before, Trump said in an August 26th Truth Social post. The president suggested Cracker Barrel could earn free publicity if it reverted the logo. They got $1 billion worth of free publicity if they play their cards right. Very tricky to do, but a great opportunity. Have a major news conference today. Make Cracker Barrel a winner again, Trump wrote. After the president's comments, the official White House X account weighed in, posting a Cracker Barrel logo with Trump as the man leaning on the barrel. Go woke, go broke, the post said. Hours after Trump's social media post, Cracker Barrel told USA Today it was returning its old-timer logo. We thank our guests for sharing their voices and love for Cracker Barrel. We said we would listen, and we have, the statement said. Our new logo is getting away and our old-timer will remain. Trump also praised the company's reversal in a Truth Social post. All of your fans very much appreciate it, he wrote. Good luck into the future, make lots of money, and most importantly, make your customers happy again. Cracker Barrel then said on September 9th that it would not be redesigning its restaurants as previously announced in March. The chain had made plans to refresh its restaurants for a younger crowd, such as cleaning up the eclectic wall decor. Only 4 of the chain's 660 restaurants were updated, but similar to the logo change, the redesign was met with backlash. You've shared your voices in recent weeks, not just on our logo, but also on our restaurants. We're continuing to listen, Cracker Barrel said in a September 9th website update. Today we're suspending our remodels. If your restaurant hasn't been remodeled, you don't need to worry. It won't be. And that ends the article. Cracker Barrel ends deal with agency pitching logo change, by Greta Cross and Malena Kahn of USA Today. And that ends the business news for today. I'll move now to the sports page. As usual in the Sunday edition, the sports page is titled Sunday Huddle. The article is titled Ranked and Ready, ASU Volleyball, Hockey in National Rankings. It's written by Jose M. Romero of the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Arizona State University's fall sports are enjoying a strong 2025, beginning with the nationally ranked football team, number 21, entering its game at Utah, and its upward trend. Sun Devil fans can also feel good about a pair of rising programs, ASU volleyball and hockey. The Sun Devils volleyball team began last week ranked 8th in the nation after a sweep of Utah on October 4th. The ASU hockey team, ranked number 15th, lost twice to then number 5 Penn State at home last weekend in its first two games of the season, but stayed in the national rankings. Sun Devils volleyball is tough at home. ASU volleyball, 12-2 overall and 3-0 in Big 12 match play entering the week, drew number 16 Baylor and number 24 Colorado on October 8th and October 10th. The defending Big 12 champion Sun Devils earned a sweep over Utah on October 4th, winning each game 25-16. The Sun Devils held the Utes to a 0.092 hitting percentage, the sixth match in a row ASU has held its opponents to under .200, and the fourth time this season that Arizona State has kept a team to a hitting percentage below 100. Arizona State went into the week with a six-match winning streak and had not lost a Big 12 match at home, with 19 conference wins in a row. Taking care of business at home is a point of focus for the team, outside hitter Bailey Miller said after the win over Utah. The Sun Devils were 28-2 at home under third-year head coach J.J. Van Neel going into the Baylor match, and there have been crowds of more than 4,000 at Desert Financial Arena in 2025. Just keeping in mind that that's one of our goals that we set, defending our court, Miller told the ASU Athletics website, and not that we play harder when we're here versus away, but just knowing that this is our court and these are our fans and we have to defend that. So we have some big games at home this year, and so I think it's just another thing to give us motivation to win. The Sun Devils, having played 6 ranked teams by October 12th, we're 2-2, taking on ranked programs going into their two matches October 8th and 10th against ranked opponents. Being steady, one step at a time, ASU setter Sidney Henry told the ASU athletic website after the Utah win, "We're not looking too futuristic. We're just focused on what's a few feet in front of us. That's the most important thing a successful team can do, because looking too far ahead is only going to kill you." After a three-match homestand that concludes with Colorado, ASU will play its next three on the road, starting with a rematch against BYU on October 16th, followed by a rematch with Utah on October 18th in Salt Lake City, and concluding with a match at Arizona on October 25th. ASU hockey looks to build on success of 2024-25 season. The Sun Devils hockey program is into its second season as a member of the National Collegiate Hockey Conference. The team's 2025-26 season opened with back-to-back losses to number 5 Penn State at home at Mullett Arena. ASU is coming off a second-place finish in the NCHC last season, with loftier goals this season after the unprecedented success of the previous campaign. Head coach Greg Powers' team aims to be playing deeper into next year. The Sun Devils hung tough against the Nittany Lions but lost the lead in back-to-back games after two periods of play. On October 3rd, ASU led 3-2 going into the third period after scoring three goals in the second, but couldn't hold it and fell 6-3. On October 4th, ASU led 2-0 through 40 minutes, but conceded four unanswered goals in the third period to lose 4-2. ASU's power play entered last week at 1-for-12. The silver lining is that that's as good as a team as you're going to see all year, Powers told ASU Athletics website after the second loss. On paper, they're arguably the most talented team in the country. I think that the odds makers have them as the favorite to win a national championship. And we had a lead on them going into the third period on both nights. We can take away that we can clearly play with anybody, but we're beyond moral victories here. The Sun Devils dropped from number 14 to number 15 after the Penn State games. They got to stay home for their icebreaker tournament, played October 10th and 11th with participating teams Alaska Fairbanks, Notre Dame, and Quinnipiac. ASU was set to face Notre Dame on October 10th at Mullett Arena, then either Alaska Fairbanks or Quinnipiac the following day. Looking ahead, the Sun Devils travel to Sioux Falls, South Dakota this week for games at Augustiana on October 17th and 18th. Friday's game is at 5 p.m. and Saturday's at 4 p.m. Both will be televised live on Fox 10 in Arizona. Augustiana plays in the Central Collegiate Hockey Association, or CCHA, and began its season October 10th at Minnesota Duluth. And that's the end of the article, ASU Volleyball and Hockey in National Rankings, by Jose M. Romero of the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. I'll take a brief moment out of the broadcast to remind those of you who may have tuned in late, this is the Sunday, October 12th, 2025 issue of the Arizona Republic. This is the second hour of the paper, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. The second article is about the WNBA Finals. The title is End of a Wild Ride. Mercury's inexplicable season falls short of title as Aces Sweep, by Jenna Ortiz of the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. Once the buzzer sounded at Mortgage Matchup Center, Kalia Copper gathered her Phoenix Mercury teammates and let them feel the emotions of the room. The shouts from the Las Vegas Aces locker room, the excitement, the energy. Copper wanted them to know the sting. "I brought us all together and said, 'Take a couple of seconds. Feel it. Hear it. You hate that feeling,' Copper said. "You hear the other team celebrating, and just remember what this feeling feels like, and remember the hurt, and remember everything you feel in this moment, and then just let them fuel you for the future." Copper isn't used to losing on the big stage. In the 2021 WNBA Finals, Copper's first finals appearance, she made herself known and won the finals MVP. At the 2024 Paris Olympics, Copper had some crucial moments as the U.S. team won the gold medal. But now, Copper and the Mercury end their season without a fourth WNBA title. The Mercury were swept by the Aces in Game 4 of the finals on Friday, October 10th. Not many people predicted that the Mercury would wind up in the finals after legend Diana Taurasi retired and center Brittany Griner signed with the Atlanta Dream. But the Mercury skipped the rebuild and did the improbable when getting stars Alyssa Thomas and Satu Sabali in a four-team trade. From there, the Mercury's identity quickly shifted from one of the league's worst defensive teams to one of the best in the regular season and postseason. And a lot of that change boils down to Thomas' impact. Known for her physical style of play, she was on Phoenix's radar for a while. "That's why I harassed her to come here," Copper said. "I just got tired of competing against her. Just going against her, I was like, I've got to go and get that one. That's the one I want. Just being out there when I looked to my left, we're going to war. It's about winning." The Mercury surprised the league early in the season and kept the momentum up to the All-Star break before hitting a slump. Phoenix fought late into the season to maintain a top-four seed in the playoffs, but still wasn't seen as a contender. In every playoff series, the Mercury weren't expected to win, but didn't buy into the noise. Instead, they knocked off the defending champion New York Liberty in the first round and stunned the top-seeded Minnesota Lynx in the semifinals. In both of those series, the Mercury quickly adjusted from a poor Game 1 performance and appeared unstoppable. Until they ran into the Aces. With superstar Aja Wilson heading an Aces team filled with depth, the Mercury couldn't find answers. Five different players guarded Wilson throughout the finals to no avail as she collected her second Finals MVP award. Adding to the sting was losing Sabali in devastating fashion when she went down with a concussion in Game 3. Sabali was unable to be at Game 4 due to her condition, and her teammates largely had to stay away due to the hospital's visitation rules. The Mercury tried everything they could in Game 4, but limped out of the season as coach Nate Tibbetts was ejected in the third quarter, and several players earned technical fouls. However, the ending didn't define how this season went. "This was a special year," Tibbetts said. "This is one of the funnest years I've had in basketball. For a new group to come together the way we did and compete, it just says a lot about who's in our locker room and everyone involved." Everyone bought into the vision of restructuring the group. I'm going to remember this year forever. It's a special year. You obviously want to get to the finals and win the finals, but it doesn't always work out the way that you want. But I just love what we started to build here. It's a great group. I'm disappointed that it's ended. And that's the end of the article. You can reach the reporter at Jenna, J-E-N-N-A, .ortiz, at arizonarepublic.com. The name of her article was End of a Wild Ride by Jenna Ortiz of the Arizona Republic and the USA Today Network. And that does it for the sports news today. I'll move now to some opinions. Our first opinion comes to us from Nicole Russell, a columnist for the USA Today. The title is, I support Trump's peace plan, but I'm not sure about trusting Hamas. Some events are so horrifying that they become unforgettable. It's been 2 years since Hamas attacked Israel, slaughtering about 1,200 people, mostly civilians, and taking 251 people hostage, including Americans. I have not forgotten what happened that day, especially to certain families like the Babasses. Maybe it's because I too am a mother, or that like Sherry Babas, I too have two beautiful ginger-haired children. But I cannot forget how jarring it was to see a video of Hamas abducting Shari, 32, and her two children, Ariel, 4 years old, and Kefir, just 9 months old. Hamas militants filmed and released the footage. Shari is seen gripping her young children, a terrified expression on her face. A mother's worst nightmare comes to life. Worse still, Hamas returned their dead bodies well over a year after their abduction. A terrorist group that will kidnap, kill, and return the dead bodies of small children and their mother in a spectacle cannot be reasoned with. And yet America is still trying. President Donald Trump is right to continue to demand that Hamas release the remaining Israeli hostages and negotiate with them until they do. He has warned Hamas leaders of complete obliteration if they remain in power in Gaza. Hamas said on October 3rd that it would release hostages with certain caveats. I'm not sure Hamas can be trusted, but I'm hopeful that a long-lasting peace deal can be reached. Trump has set forth a 20-point peace plan with conditions like redeveloping Gaza, giving Hamas amnesty, and forcing Hamas to give up governance of the Gaza Strip. Hamas has given no indication that it desires to give up power. One former hostage, Tal Shoham, who Hamas held in captivity for 505 days in Gaza, does not think peace is possible with Hamas. I believe that peace is something that we can achieve, but after I saw the magnitude of hatred that they grew up upon and they are growing their children upon, it's really clear that at least in our generation, it won't be possible, Shoham told Reuters recently. Republicans, too, have doubts that these negotiations will be fruitful. Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican South Carolina, posted on X that the way Hamas responded to Trump is unfortunately predictable. No disarmament, keeping Gaza under Palestinian control, and tying hostage release to negotiations, along with other problems, Graham wrote. This is, in essence, a rejection by Hamas of President Trump's take-it-or-leave-it proposal. Hamas freed some hostages, including during a brief ceasefire in January, but the terrorists' refusal to release all of the hostages has resulted in Israel's unrestrained approach to self-defense, an all-out war. Israel will not stop defending itself, and it should not, until Hamas gives up. To say these are grievous human rights violations is an understatement. Yet Israel is often criticized for this defense. Even the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory said in a September 16th report that Israel has committed genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. According to Hamas, Israeli forces have killed more than 67,000 people in Gaza. These are extraordinary numbers. The deaths of innocent men, women, and children in Gaza and Israel should be a somber reminder of the cost of war. It might be hard for Americans to understand the war raging in Gaza, but we have seen aftershocks of anti-Semitism since then, especially on college campuses, raising concerns about growing anti-Semitism in the United States among young people. In 2024, pro-Palestinian protests at Columbia University were so raucous that classes had to be held virtually. Similar demonstrations happened at Yale and Harvard. In May, two Israeli embassy staff members were killed outside a Jewish museum in our nation's capital. Yaron Lischinsky and Sarah Lynn Milgram were devoted to promoting peace between Israel and Palestinians and were soon to be engaged. People said the suspect shouted, "Free Palestine! Free Palestine!" after he was taken into custody. Two young lives in America cut short by anti-Semitism. This is unacceptable in America. The consequences of what Hamas perpetrated in Israel had a ripple effect across the globe. The United States must stand with Israel and bring about peace. Hamas must agree to Trump's deal, release the hostages for the hundreds they killed, and especially to honor families like Sheree, Ariel, and Kafir Babas, who will never return home. That is the end of the article. The title was, "I Support Trump's Peace Plan, But I'm Not Sure About Trusting Hamas," by Nicole Russell, a columnist for USA Today. The second opinion is titled, "Trump's Higher Education Compact is the Wrong Way to Fix Universities." It's written by David Ramadan, who served in the Virginia House of Delegates from 2012 to 2016 and is a professor of practice at George Mason University's Schar School and a scholar at the University of Virginia's Center for Politics. The Trump administration's latest move to reshape higher education, its so-called Compact for Academic Excellence in Higher Education, is a dangerous overreach, even if parts sound appealing at first glance. Yes, freezing tuition, expanding science, technology, engineering, and math education, and promoting conservative voices in academia are worthy goals. But using the power of the federal government to pressure universities into political compliance sets a precedent no conservative should support. As a lifelong conservative, a former Republican legislator, and now a professor at George Mason University, I have long argued that conservatives should engage with, not retreat from, our institutions of higher learning. But this is not engagement. This is coercion, an attempt to remake higher education through executive fiat and financial threat. Let's be clear. This compact is not a voluntary partnership. It's a federally imposed ideological checklist. Sign on and your institution gets favorable treatment. Decline and you risk losing vital research funding and federal support. That's not conservative reform. That's an abuse of power. The compact sent to nine top universities would give colleges priority access to federal research funds in exchange for signing on to a pledge of ideological and operational changes. Those demands include freezing tuition for 5 years, capping international student enrollment, adopting strict definitions of gender, changing governance structures, and pledging to prevent punishing conservative ideas. Some of these ideas, like controlling tuition costs, are worth debating, but tying federal funding to sweeping political conditions is an abuse of power. Federal interference in both private and state schools on this scale is unprecedented. It undermines the autonomy of institutions that are supposed to be governed by their boards, state legislatures, and marketplace of ideas, not D.C. For decades, conservatives have championed limited federal government, local control, and the protection of free speech. This proposal runs afoul of all three. This is not just a cultural skirmish. It's a fundamental shift in how government interacts with academic institutions. It sets a dangerous precedent. If one administration can punish universities for failing to adopt its political priorities, what happens when the next administration tries the same? Ironically, a compact marketed as protecting conservative viewpoints would in practice weaken free speech. Once the federal government starts dictating ideological conditions for funding, no one's speech is safe. Conservatives should be the first to say no to this kind of political coercion. Universities flourish when they are places of debate, disagreement, and rigorous inquiry, not when they are forced into lockstep with any administration's political agenda. Do our universities need to change? Absolutely. We need more intellectual diversity, more conservative faculty and administrators, and more responsiveness to workforce and civic needs. I've called for all of that openly and recently. However, that change must come through engagement, persuasion, and policy, not federal strong-arming. Take, for example, the idea of recruiting more conservative voices to campus. I support it, but instead of mandating quotas or top-down directives, why not offer competitive federal grants to universities that voluntarily prioritize civic and intellectual diversity? Why not incentivize public service fellows, adjunct scholars, or military veterans to teach in our classrooms? Solutions exist that preserve academic freedom and actually expand the range of ideas students encounter. The compact's call to cap international student enrollment is particularly misguided. International students are not just cultural assets, they're financial lifelines. They subsidize American students, fuel research labs, and contribute billions to our economy. Curtailing that pipeline doesn't punish university elites. It hurts all students, including first-generation Americans and working-class people. As I wrote recently in USA Today, when the government targets public universities, it's not the faculty or administrators who suffer, it's the students. They're the ones who lose access to degrees, job training, research opportunities, and upward mobility. This compact would inject uncertainty into academic planning, invite legal battles, and further politicize an already polarized landscape. Public universities are not perfect, but they remain among America's most important engines of innovation, economic development, and civic preparation. If conservatives want to lead, they must do so with vision and engagement, not vengeance. This compact doesn't elevate conservative ideas, it weaponizes them. And that's not leadership, it's intimidation. That's the end of the article written by David Ramadan. His title was, Trump's Higher Education Compact is the Wrong Way to Fix Universities. Our next opinion is provided by Abigail Van Buren in her Dear Abby column. Fiance proves again and again that he's no Prince Charming. Dear Abby, I am a 60-year-old divorcee. I am dating a Danish man and have been for a year. He asked me to marry him several months ago, and I said yes. He wants me and my daughter to move to Denmark. My daughter is 21 and high-functioning autistic, but she still needs me to help with executive functions. Several months ago, I lost my second job. I got behind on my rent and was evicted. My daughter and I had no place to go and went to live with a friend in another state. When I asked my fiancé if he could please help me a little, he refused and became angry, saying he didn't want to become a sugar daddy. He tells me often how much he makes and what he has in the bank. I told him I wasn't asking for jewelry or fancy clothes, just $2,000 so we wouldn't lose our home. He told me to ask my ex-husband for the money. Because he refused, my daughter and I were evicted from our home. I eventually found a second job, but the damage had been done. At the beginning of our relationship, I was upfront about my daughter most likely needing to live with us and asked if it was a deal-maker. He said no. Now he wants her to get out as soon as possible, in a foreign country where she doesn't know the language and has her issues. He also told me I couldn't keep my cat. When I expressed how this made me feel, he became angry and told me we were through and he wasn't going to help me. I am not the kind of person who would take advantage of anyone. I have always worked hard. I feel family should help each other, and because we are engaged, our problems should be shared. I don't know what to do about our relationship now. My daughter is also hurt that he doesn't want her to be with us. He has said if she stayed, he would get his own apartment. Advice? Signed, Going Abroad from Maryland. Dear Going, how many red flags do you need? Your fiancé is tight with money, even when he knows you are drowning. He has no intention of living under the same roof with your daughter, who may be unable to adjust to that new society. Understand that if you move to Denmark, he isn't going to change. This is who he is. For your daughter's sake and your own, end the engagement. This is not the kind of husband you need. Dear Abby, there's a boy in a grade above me. When he gets mad that a girl doesn't like him or his friend, he slut-shames them and calls them whores. Girls in my grade have tried to shake it off, but it won't stop. We don't want to resort to violence, but we might have to. What should we do? Signed, At Our Wit's End. Dear Wit's End, violence is never the answer. The girls who have been slut-shamed should tell their parents what has been going on and then inform the teachers and the administrators of your school. In the good old days, that boy's mouth would have been washed out with soap. And that ends Abby's opinions today. The title was Fiancé Proves Again and Again That He's No Prince Charming. And that ends the opinions today. I have time to squeeze in some birthdays today. Actor Lin Shaye turns 82. Broadcast journalist Chris Wallace, 78. Author Richard Price, 76. Actor Hiroki Sanada, 65. Musician Chris Botti, 63. Actor Carlos Bernard, 63. Singer Bob Schneider of Ugly Americans, 60. Actor Hugh Jackman is 57. Singer Marty McGuire from The Chicks, 56. Actor Kurt Cameron, 55. Reality TV star Erica Dixon is 41. Actor Josh Hutcherson, 33. Instagram celebrity Alyssa Scott, 32. Actor Ferdia Welsh Pilo, 26. And actor Aris Apatow, 23. And those were brought to us by USA Today Network. I'll now page over to your horoscope. I'll begin with Aries, March 21st to April 19th. You leveled up your social circle. Taurus, April 20th to May 20th. Recalibrating from a professional reset. Pluto has been retrograde in your career zone, but tomorrow it goes direct. Gemini, May 21st to June 21st. Are you feeling lighter? You've ditched a belief that was seriously weighing you down. Cancer, June 22nd to July 22nd. Cultivating trust is a process. Discovering who's in your corner, who wasn't worth your investment, has been revealed. Leo, July 23rd to August 22nd. Recently rocked by relationship drama, you reevaluated what you look for in a partnership. Virgo, August 23rd to September 22nd. You eliminated a bad habit once and for all. A health message has been hammered home. Libra, September 23rd to October 23rd. Seeking true love? The difference between passion and peril in matters of the heart has been highlighted. Scorpio, October 24th to November 21st. Domestic dynamics are no longer serving you. Sagittarius, November 22nd to December 21st. Secrets out in the open? Now you have this information. What will you do with it? Capricorn, December 22nd to January 19th. Stop paying so much for your money. Aquarius, January 20th to February 18th. Feeling like a whole new you? You shed skin. Claim your power. And Pisces, February 19th to March 20th. The call was coming from inside the house. You revisited your past. What did you find? And that was the horoscope for today, Sunday, October 12th, 2025. I'll finish the broadcast today with a look at a few of the comics. I'll begin with Pickles. The scene is Earl is sitting on the couch with the dog, and his wife Opal is standing up addressing him. Earl, who dressed you this morning? Earl says, huh? Opal says, you're wearing one brown shoe and one black shoe. Earl says, yeah, is that a problem? I believe in equality for shoes of all colors, sizes, and arch supports. Opal says, in other words, you got dressed without putting on your glasses again. Next is Beetle Bailey by Greg Bryan and Neil Walker. Beetle has been called to the sarge's bed. Sarge is sitting on his bed. Beetle says, what's up? His sarge says, nothing. Beetle says, it looks like you're a bit down in the dumps. Sarge says, I'm okay. Beetle says, you can level with me. We're buddies, aren't we? Sarge says, I just wonder if I should have joined the army. Beetle says, don't doubt yourself. This is where you belong. You wouldn't be good in normal society anyway. And the sarge yells at him, get back to your bunk, you blankety-blankety-blank. And then he has this Cheshire grin on his face, and he says, I'm good at that. Next up is Blondie by Dean Young and John Marshall. Dagwood is sitting in his chair, and there's coming from across the street, whomp, 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 and Dagwood says, I can't take it anymore. That new guy who moved in across the street is blasting his sound system again. Blondie says, I heard, dear. Dagwood says, I'm going to march right over there and tell him to crank that noise down several notches. Blondie said, have you seen him yet, dear? He looks like he could be a professional wrestler or something. You can call the Homeowners Association and they can have a talk with him. And then the next scene is him back in his chair, and the whump, 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 whump sound is coming, and Dagwood says, I guess it's not all that bad. And here's good old Charlie Brown in Peanuts by Schultz. The scene is Snoopy is sitting on his doghouse along with Woodstock. Woodstock has a little crown on his head. Snoopy says, you've been elected Grand Master of your lodge. How nice. It's a new organization. How interesting. Over 200 members already? That's great. How often do you meet? Once a month, I see. And where do you plan to hold your meetings? And the next scene is the whole doghouse. Snoopy and Woodstock are surrounded by small yellow birds, and Snoopy says, I might have known. And that's it for the comics today, and that also ends the broadcast. This has been the second hour of the Sunday, October 12, 2025 issue of the Arizona Republic, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week, and keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.